Okay, welcome back. Thank you, Bonnie, so much. The topic for tonight is equanimity, which is a funny word, isn't it? I find, anyway, when I first started practicing meditation, it was January of 1971 in this town, Bodh Gaya, India. And the teacher was a man, an Indian man named Goenka. He was my first teacher. And it was the context was an intensive 10-day retreat. And Goenka would often say as a guidance, as an instruction, be equanimous, be equanimous. And we would look at one another and say, is that a word? Like, what in the world does equanimous mean? Like, whoever used that word? And it's actually, like many of these words, many of these concepts, it's a little difficult to understand just as a concept. It's much better to have a kind of experimentation and to explore it in terms of an experience. Because the word equanimity can imply to us indifference, coldness, not caring, almost a kind of sullen withdrawal, a little bit of hidden hostility. There's so many things that can be associated with that word. The word really does mean balance, and it plays out in two different ways. There's the balance that leads to wisdom. And that's the quality of balance that is within mindfulness. Mindfulness is another word that is somewhat difficult to understand. So many of the ways mindfulness is described, things like we're going to be with our experience in the present moment without judgment. Which sounds like maybe you're going to be a little stupid, right? Or we're going to accept things the way that they are, which also sounds tremendously passive and complacent. So I was teaching once, not even that long ago, actually, and I was leading the first sitting, and it was very much like the instruction we just did. I started with sit down and feel your breath. Sit down and listen to sound before you begin to feel your breath. And immediately somebody raised his hand and he said, well, what if it's the sound of the smoke alarm that I hear going off? Should I sit here mindfully knowing that the smoke alarm is going off, or should I get up? And I said, I'd get up. But I also really understand the question, because doesn't it sound like that a little bit? We're going to accept things the way that they are. We're going to be with our experience in the present moment without judgment. But mindfulness is not meant to be this passive, submissive, uncritical state. It's really very dynamic, very vibrant, very alive, and not so burdened by instant reaction, old habits just determining our whole experience. The prevalence of a concept of assumption, preconception, just in a hidden way, really determining our experience. So, a few years ago, I have a friend who's a sculptor. I don't think we say sculptress anymore, but that's what she is. She's a sculptor. And she told me she was going to have a piece on exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery in D.C., which is part of the Smithsonian. And that, of course, was like hugely exciting for her. And I happened to be on my way to D.C. and staying in a place very close to the National Portrait Gallery. So I said, I'll definitely go see it. And I did. I went to the museum. And being part of the Smithsonian, it has certain architectural implications, that statement. Huge, vast corridors and It's a certain kind of architecture. And I walked up and down and up and down and up and down those corridors looking for her piece. I did not see it anywhere. And I walked up and down and up and down. And my mind went all the way to just my luck. I'm going to have to be the one to tell her. They decided to just stick it in the basement, you know. They didn't put it up after all. And I walked up and down. I was just getting ready to leave. And I kind of casually, I just sort of turned for some reason. And my head went over my shoulder. And I saw her piece up against the wall. Like, I had just made the assumption it was a freestanding piece. So I was only looking like in the central aisle of those corridors. She'd never said that. And I could not see it because I had a sort of tunnel vision based on that assumption, right? So that is what mindfulness challenges, is the ways that assumption contours our vision. We have a kind of tunnel vision. There's so much we're missing. We're not seeing. We're in an immediate reactive state, which takes over. Either something comes up and we're sucked right into it and we're overwhelmed by it, or we hate it, we fear it, we can't stand it, we try to push it away. Those two extremes of reaction are what we generally fall into. And we say that mindfulness slices right down the middle of those two, so that we don't get consumed by something right away, so that we lose all perspective. And we also don't fight against and struggle against our experience so much. And that's why mindfulness is said to be the basis for wisdom, for understanding, for a radical revisioning of our sense of who we are and where happiness is to be found and what strength really is. You know, so we're not so lost in either the conditioning coming in toward us from outside or just the old burdens we might still be carrying. We have the opportunity to see things more clearly. So it's like a training in uncluttering our attention. That ability not to immediately react doesn't mean we don't care. It means that we're trying to see clearly with some perspective, trying to see broadly rather than being so lost in tunnel vision. And that ingredient in mindfulness that gives us that is equanimity. It's balance. Doesn't mean you don't care. It means that you want some perspective. And we all know probably what it's like. Say you're going into a meeting and you're rigidly holding on to a kind of agenda in your head about a resolution, and maybe 50 other resolutions come up and you just can't even open to that because you've just got this like fixation. It's not really a very effective way to operate. Probably my favorite example these days of mindfulness is, it's just an image. It's like, say you're on your way to a party and you run into a friend. And the friend says, you know who I met today for the first time? I met that new colleague, the new person who's going to work with us. And they are really, really, really boring. And then you go to the party, and who do you get stuck talking to but that very person you have just been told is really, really, really boring. So what's the likelihood that you're really going to listen to them? You're really going to look at them? You're really going to take in anything that they say? Much more likely you're going to think about the 50 emails you need to write. Or you're going to look around, like, who would I rather be talking to? Anybody. And maybe you realize that and you think, you know what? I don't even know for myself that I find this person really boring. That was someone else's impression. What if I leave that aside for now and I really listen and I really look? And if you do that, maybe you come to the end of that evening and you walk out of the party and you think, you know what? That new person, I think they're really boring. But maybe not, because life is full of surprises when we pay attention. Right? So it's not like you never have a feeling, you never have a response. But it doesn't have to be that kind of driven, automatic reaction, which leaves us not really seeing very clearly. So mindfulness is the precursor to insight. And to have genuine mindfulness means the development of this quality of equanimity. Because mindfulness is such a common word these days, it's hard to quite get that aspect of it, but I think it's really the crucial aspect of it. It's not just knowing there's a sound, it's knowing in a certain way. It's not just knowing there's an emotion, it's knowing in a certain way. And that way, for want of a better word, is described as balanced. Balance doesn't mean you're never going to draw a conclusion or you're going to let the smoke alarm go off while you sit here mindfully. It means that you have a kind of flexibility, a fluidity of intelligence, of awareness, so that you can recognize, oh, this is being caught in fixation or tunnel vision. Let me open up. Let me get a bigger picture. Or what has often been a very favorite example of mine comes from an article that I read some years ago, really a long time ago, in the New York Times about a pilot program bringing mindfulness into schools. So this was a fourth grade classroom. And it was really, in general, it was a very good article, but there were two parts I liked especially. So one was they asked the researcher something, and he said, all day long we tell kids to pay attention, but we never teach them how. And then they asked one of the kids, so he's like 9 or 10 years old, right? So they said, what is mindfulness? What is mindfulness? And he said, mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, great definition. Mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. Because what does that imply? It implies you know you're feeling angry when you start to feel angry. Not 15 consequential actions later. Not after you've hit someone in the mouth. Not after you've sent that email. But when it's beginning. We're so in touch. We're so aware. And it implies a certain balanced relationship to that anger. If you get overwhelmed, you lose any sense of being centered, any sense of space, you probably hit a lot of people in the mouth. I mean, life can be very frustrating. And at the same time, if you hate what you're feeling and you fear it and you try to repress it and you try to deny it, you get tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, and then you explode. So to be able to know what we're feeling quickly, to have a balanced or more balanced relationship to that feeling creates space. And in that space, we have insight, we have options. Maybe you have time to reflect, you know what? Hit someone in the mouth last week, didn't work out that well. Maybe I'll try this, maybe I'll try that. And so then I'll tell you my Katie Couric story, because it kind of fits, maybe. So I suddenly got this invitation to go on the Katie Couric show. It was taped some weeks ago. It just was on like last Tuesday or something. With a psychologist friend of mine who was talking about mindfulness. The show is on mindfulness. The two segments are on mindfulness. So the psychologist friend was talking about some of the neuroscience and some of the research, and together we did this one segment. But the really great segment, honestly, was the next one. Where by this time, my friend Donna and I were seated in the front row of the audience. And the two people on the stage with Katie Couric were two people from a mindful schools kind of program in Richmond, California. And one of them was talking about how he'd initiated this program because the district he was working in was like decimated in so many ways, and he was like amazingly depressed at what little impact he felt he was making. And then he decided, you know, maybe I can't change the system, but I can work with my classroom and do this very grassroots kind of approach. And so he introduced a mindfulness program. So then sitting next to me in the studio audience in the front row were this little boy and his mom. The little boy clearly was part of the program, you know, and they'd flown them out there. So Katie Couric turns, the camera goes to the mom, and she said, "What did mindfulness do for your son?" And she said, "He was really," and this is obviously a paraphrase, but you can see it all if you go to the link. She said he was really going downhill. His older brother got killed, and he was devastated, and he couldn't function in school, and things were really getting bad. And then he did this mindfulness program, and it was so much better. So then the camera goes to the little boy, who's, I don't know, 8 years old, 9 years old, something like that, who's sitting right next to me. And Katie Couric from the stage said, "What did mindfulness do for you?" And he said something like, "It taught me how to feel my anger without acting on it. It taught me how to deal with my grief." And then they had a little interchange about grief. And then he said something else like, "It taught me how to enjoy things again or have fun again." So, Mary, you have to understand, I have been heavily made up 4 times at this point. I have like makeup out to here. And I started crying. And he's sitting right next to me in the audience. And I thought, I bet there are black streaks going all the way down my face. Yeah. But it was so moving, because it's so true. That's like the trajectory of the equanimity within mindfulness being strengthened and cultivated, and what it creates for us, that kind of space, that sense of options. Doesn't mean you're cold and cut off and indifferent and you don't care. It's a very different way of being that is extraordinarily connected, but not so lost in all of those old habits. There's a way in which we have a sense of repose. It's like we have a place of some peace we can come back to in the cultivation of equanimity. It doesn't mean you don't care, and it doesn't mean there are no more ups and downs. There are plenty of ups and downs. But we're not quite so defined by them. So now I'll tell you my favorite story from my book, Real Happiness at Work, because I think it also ties into this a little bit. So the story is about this time I was in New York City. I was downtown, and I was trying to get a taxi to go midtown, because the Vietnamese Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, was going to give a lecture. And you know, he's like 88 years old, and it was a very precious thing, and somewhat rare. And I had left, leaving where I was, a little bit late. And there are certain, even though taxis, of course, cruise the streets of New York, there are certain periods of time when it's often quite difficult to get a cab because they're about to change shift. So the drivers are just going someplace where they're going to drop off the cab, and then the next driver is going to take it for the next shift. And so what happens in those periods of time is that occasionally a taxi will stop and they'll ask you where you're going, because if your destination is close to where they're going to drop off the cab, they'll let you get in and you're like the last fare of the day. So that's what happened to me. This taxi finally stopped and let me in, and we started going. And we got caught in the most unbelievable, terrible, horrific, awful, unthinkable traffic. Like, I had never seen anything like it. We were going nowhere. And I felt really bad. First I thought, never going to make it to Thich Nhat Hanh. And I felt really bad for the driver. I thought, wow, he was nice enough to pick me up. He's definitely going to be late. I don't know what happens when you're late. I don't know if you get a fine. I don't know if you get penalized in some way. So I said to him, I am so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. I know you're going to be late. The traffic is unbelievable. I've never seen traffic like this. And then he said to me, first he said, Madam, traffic is not your fault. And then he said, nor is it mine. And I thought, wow, I didn't even have to go here, Thich Nhat Hanh. I just had an enlightened cab driver. And I especially love that second one, nor is it mine. Because I thought, how many times a day is he likely blamed for something that's not his fault? Right? A bridge is closed. Or like, here's going to happen here. A bridge is closed. There's crazy traffic. An awful driver on the road. It's not his fault. But how often do we take it on? Especially if it's coming our way, right? That kind of blame. And to have that sense of dignity and balance, nor is it mine. So that became like my new mantra. I thought I will remember this. And he got me to the lecture with like 0 seconds to spare. If any of you have ever seen Thich Nhat Hanh, you know he's like incredibly graceful. So he was like gracefully walking to the stage, on the stage, when I like ran to my seat like a maniac, you know. But I did make it. But isn't that great? Nor is it mine. That's balance. It's not coldness. It's not indifference. It's real balance that can help us be centered as we get praised, as we get blamed, as just all these things happen. And it's a beautiful state. So that's one major meaning of equanimity. The other major meaning of equanimity we're going to go into much more over the weekend, which is not so much the balance that leads to wisdom, but the balance that's born of wisdom. Because having perspective, seeing more clearly, leads to its own kind of balance or its own kind of peace. It's like the balance when you have a genuine sense of compassion and you have the wisdom, it's not in my hands, right? I can't make this person get better or change. It's the balance that remembers everything is moving, it's changing, it's transitory all the time. It's the balance that recognizes what we cannot control. And the role that plays with loving kindness and compassion and other qualities of the heart. Not to diminish them or have us pull back from them, but to really expand them. Practices like loving kindness or compassion are said to be practices of generosity. They're like dana or generosity. They may not be material generosity, but they're generosity of the spirit. And we all know it's very possible to give in a whole variety of different ways, right? We can give somebody something and it's a freely given gift. Or we can give somebody something and it's like, thank me, would you? Or put it on right away. I don't care that it's summer, you know, and it's a scarf. It's like, or tell me it's the best book you've ever read in your entire life. Right? There's so many, or give me that in exchange. I mean, there's so many possibilities for the quality of our giving. Just as there are so many possibilities for the quality of our compassion or our loving kindness. And when it's infused with equanimity, it means there are not so many strings attached. We give fully, wholeheartedly, we're present, we care, we try, and there's wisdom, there's understanding. I am sadly not in control of the universe. I will do everything I can to make a difference, and there's a big letting go involved. Because we can't insist someone thank us or get better or put on the scarf right away. Right? So equanimity, again, it doesn't mean coldness or indifference. It's kind of spaciousness. And part of where it's born is realizing how much we don't know. You know, sometimes we do something and we so much count on seeing an immediate effect. But we don't always see an immediate effect. It doesn't mean nothing happened. So many times what we've done is kind of like planted a seed. And when we're lucky, in some period of time after, we see that seed bear fruit, or we see what's happened from it. But we can't insist on seeing the whole picture right now, because we don't know. Equanimity is born from some amount of recognizing how much we don't know. That maybe healing has its own rhythm. Cause and effect isn't always so cut and dried, although we can sense the consequences of our actions. We do what we can do, and there's a kind of letting nature take its course. You know, my friend Joseph Goldstein sometimes tells the story about growing his first, and I believe his only, garden. And he was about 9 years old, and he says that when the little green fluffy stuff would come up on top of the carrots, he'd pull up the carrots to help them grow faster, which I imagine is why it was his only garden. But we can be so like that, right? Sometimes we have to plant the seed and take care of it and let nature take its course. There's a big letting go in that. That's the equanimity. To love someone and realize we cannot stop change. It's just not possible. To live in resentment or defiance of how things are, like the truth of change, is like the proverbial banging your head against the wall. It's not going to happen the way you want it to happen, that you're always in control. You can hold on successfully. Life just isn't like that. So in the Buddhist tradition, and again, we'll talk so much more about this over the weekend, they talk about what are called the eight vicissitudes in life. Just stuff that happens in life for everyone. And that is pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Like, that's a life. There is no one in this life who experiences only pleasure and no pain. We go up, we go down, there's pleasure and pain, and gain and loss, and praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. It's how it is for everybody. And it doesn't mean that, you know, the teaching doesn't mean that we don't notice the difference, or that we don't care, or we don't try for anything. It's not like that at all. But the question is usually, how much do we care? Does having a difficult challenge just devastate us? When things are great, do we get kind of complacent and think it's going to last forever? Or can we have a different relationship to the ups and the downs that has some of this element of wisdom manifesting? I mean, how much do we blame ourselves for things that are not our fault? That's an interesting investigation, right? And it doesn't mean they don't feel bad. They do feel bad. And yet, they feel much worse when we heap all of that blame, as though we should have been able to control it, as though there should be no pain in this life, which I think is a little bit the cultural message. You know, it all should be like perfect and under control. So what happens when it's not, which is frequent? Can we recognize this as a part of life? I want to have the resources or the resiliency to deal with this more skillfully, or do we just go down? Because we feel we should have been in control to begin with. So they say that equanimity really works well with these three other qualities, the four of them, which are often talked about together as these qualities known as the four Brahmaviharas that came up in the introduction. So Brahma means Sanskrit means celestial or supreme. The translation I heard for it that I liked a lot was the word best. Vihara means dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these qualities form our best home. And like any home, we may not be there all the time. We don't just stay home. But when we return there, there is a certain feeling. We feel safe. We feel authentic. We feel ourselves. It should be the place where we can relax, be at ease. We're home. So these four qualities are said to form our best home. The first is loving kindness. And that is really a deep sense of knowing of connection. Loving kindness doesn't mean you like everybody. It actually doesn't even mean you like anybody. But there is a kind of resonance that our lives have something to do with one another, that we live in an interconnected universe. And a corollary to that is everybody counts. Everybody matters. You're not going to take everyone home with you, but everybody counts. So it is like this felt sense of inclusion, rather than being so caught in the corrosive rigidity of self and other, and us and them. The second of the Brahmaviharas is the quality of compassion, which is defined in the tradition as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's an actual movement of the heart. It's like a going toward to see if we can be of help. The third of the Brahmaviharas is the state called sympathetic joy. Some people don't like that translation because they, you know, the tendency is to think of sympathy as somehow connected to compassion. But anyway, that's the translation. I like it, so I'll use it. Sympathetic joy. It means feeling joy in the happiness of others. Rather than witnessing someone's success or good fortune and falling sway to the voice which so often arises within us that says, "Ew, I wish you had a little bit less going for you right now." You know, like, you don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a bit, I'd feel better, right? Very familiar voice. Sympathetic joy is like the opposite of that. It's realizing that someone else's happiness does not threaten our own happiness. It can be our own happiness. So again, we'll talk much more about this tomorrow and the next day. And then the last of the Brahmaviharas, which in some systems, interestingly enough, comes first, is equanimity. So it's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And when I first heard that, you know, like way back in my learning meditation, I thought, what's that doing there? You know, like I could sense the relationship or the resonance of the first three. And then equanimity, I thought, that's kind of clumsy there. You know, what's that doing there? Because I probably did have some association in my mind with being cold or withdrawn or something like that. But remember, it's the voice of wisdom. It's the articulation of wisdom. It's saying that wisdom can feed our loving kindness. It can infuse our compassion. It will make those states better, not worse. When wisdom is there, understanding is there, balance is there, letting go is there, peace is there. So some systems within the Buddhist tradition actually do start with teaching about equanimity and practices to cultivate it. In this tradition of Theravadan Buddhism, especially those schools found in places like Burma, which are really the schools that most informed my own teaching and training. Equanimity is the last of the Brahmaviharas, but that's in part because there's so much conversation about mindfulness, which also has equanimity hidden in there. So we have the balance that leads to wisdom, which is in the mindfulness, and then we have the balance that's born of wisdom, which is all about how we are relating to ourselves and to others. And so it's a tremendous, tremendous and interesting quality. Okay, so I think I'm just going to open up for comments, questions, dialogue, whatever you want to talk about. We have some kind person who's going to walk around with a microphone. And do I have to repeat the questions? Okay. Anybody? You're in charge.
Hi, Sharon. Thanks for coming.
Sure.
What's coming to me is I realized in this talk how much I enjoyed and valued and used the phrases for meta practice, loving kindness practice. And I remember hearing at least the version that someone was teaching me about the phrasing for equanimity practice and feeling that it kind of like that. So I was just wondering if you thought about that and just some share the way you work with that.
Okay, so there are several ways that equanimity as a quality is particularly strengthened. One is just doing mindfulness practice. It will strengthen that factor of equanimity because you can't really be mindful without some equanimity in there. You're doing something else. You're just getting more attentive, but you're not getting more mindful. And there is also an equanimity practice within the context of these four Brahmaviharas. There are practices for deepening loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity as distinct practices. Very often in current time, the four are brought together through one vehicle like loving kindness, and it would be the wisdom factor in loving kindness, the ability to have less conditionality around the giving that brings forth the equanimity. But you can actually do an equanimity practice. All of those practices, those four practices, are done not by centering our attention on the feeling of the breath, as we did earlier, but by centering our attention around the silent repetition of certain phrases. And the phrases, while being words, are imperfect, but they are the conduit for moving out of a certain ordinary rut of attention and kind of experimenting with paying attention differently. So with loving kindness, for example, common phrases are things like, may I be happy, may you be happy, may I be peaceful, may you be peaceful. And that helps challenge what might be our obsession in just looking for everyone's faults all the time, my own and others, right? So it's a way of shifting the way we're paying attention through the repetition of the phrases. And each of those practices does have a its own set of phrases. So the classical phrases for equanimity practice, I don't know if these are the ones that you heard or not, are beginning, well, actually in that case you don't begin with yourself. All beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. All beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. Now, a lot of people don't like those phrases. The word karma is so vastly misconstrued. Sounds like victim blaming. It's not meant to do any of that. The idea, I mean, for us, probably in contemporary psychological language, we would say it doesn't help anybody to be codependent, right? So maybe you have a friend who's really in trouble, and you do sense what they can do to be a whole lot happier. And it's not just being nosy. You're kind of right. And you cannot make them do it. You just cannot. It's just not how life is. And I think it's really fascinating to look at the times we give up. And just do that kind of thought experiment. You know, look at the past, look at the present. When are the times you think, I'm burnt out, I cannot be here anymore? And look to see, I mean, certainly when I do that, I often see an element within that moment of feeling just powerless. I can't make any difference at all. It's not worth being here. Right? So what equanimity is saying, not that you don't care, but maybe there is a way to be there differently. So within that very classical context, that's what that is saying. I care about you and I cannot control life. I can't control your decisions. I can't control your actions. Those decisions and those actions are going to play a very big part in your degree of happiness. That's what those phrases are actually saying. All beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. And if nothing else, it's an injunction toward patience. We may not know the result of our effort for a good long time, if ever. But that is not a guarantee that there is no result. So that's the sensibility it's meant to evoke. And if those words, and it's the case with all of these practices, as we'll explore this weekend, if those words seem wrong to you or you're struggling with that, it's not worth it. It's much better to change the words and find a way of expressing, even if it's not perfect, it's better, you know, than the struggle words. You know, so I usually say, like in teaching loving kindness, see if you can find good enough phrases so that you can actually do the practice and not just be sitting there thinking, oh God, you know, may you be happy. I don't think so, you know. You get really lazy when you're happy, you know. I can't have that. So, because then we're not concentrating at all, right? We're just doing what we normally do. So for it to actually be a concentration practice, the phrases need to be good enough, so it's perfectly fine. That doesn't mean great, however. You may not find the phrases great, but if they're good enough, then I would go for it.
May I be mentally happy, physically happy, and at ease of my
So I went to Burma in 1985. I began my meditation practice altogether in 1971 in India, but then in 85 I went to Burma, which was the first time I had the chance to do intensive, structured loving-kindness practice with some guidance. And I really wanted that for quite a lot of years, so I was really happy that that came into being. And in that practice, you know, as I said, we gather our attention around the repetition of certain phrases. And the phrases are all translations anyway, and there I was in Burma, and the phrases that I was given, beginning with myself, because you then go on to extend this to others, and finally all beings everywhere, the phrases were, may I be free from danger, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering, may I have ease of well-being, or may I live with ease. And that last, may I live with ease or may I have ease of well-being, means in the things of day-to-day life like livelihood and family, may it not be such a struggle. May I live with ease. So, may I be free from danger, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering, may I live with ease or may I have ease of well-being. And I spent 3 months in Burma intensively practicing using those phrases, or, you know, may you and may all, that kind of extension. And it was, for me, it was an extraordinary transformative time. It really changed my life. So I came back and I started teaching metta. I'd always, you know, I'd been teaching for years, but teaching mindfulness. So I started teaching metta, or loving kindness. Metta means loving kindness. And I taught in, this is like a California joke, this comment, I taught in Massachusetts and it was fine. And I taught in Barry and it was fine. I taught in Boston, it was fine. Then I went on to California. And I was leading a retreat and I opened the first sitting, loving kindness retreat, I opened with describing those phrases, which were my phrases, which I had used to such powerful effect in Burma. And we had one sitting, I rang the bell, and by the time I looked up, there was a line of people waiting to complain to me that stretched like all the way to that back wall where all you high people are back there. And people kept saying, I don't want to repeat a word like danger, it's not good to say suffering, 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 even though it's like free of suffering, free of suffering, free of suffering. So I had had an amazing time in Burma using those very phrases. And at the same time, I know it's not good to struggle with the words in that way. So that's why, as many of you know, we have shifted that commonly, although sometimes I talk about those phrases that I used in Burma because that's what resonates for some people the most. But usually they're described as beginning with yourself, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And that may be a more palatable way of phrasing it for some people. Danger means inner and outer danger. Inner danger is very clear. The ways we can make things a whole lot worse, right? It doesn't mean there's no challenge, there's no bad feeling, but we know when we pay attention. We have an unpleasant feeling in the body or an unpleasant emotion. We have heartache, we have disappointment. And often the first thing we do is we extend it into the future. What's it going to feel like tomorrow? What's it going to feel like next month? What's it going to feel like for the entire rest of my life? Feeling this disappointment or this fear or whatever it is, or this pain. So not only are we dealing with the present moment's difficulty, we have now added to it a tremendous amount of time of anticipation. And that is impossible to deal with right now. And it really hurts. So we've made things worse just through that habit. Or maybe we have the tendency to hold difficulty in isolation, to feel it's only me. No one else is hurting or has ever been hurt in this life. It's only me. Or I cannot let anyone help me because it's only me. I have people who say they want to be there for me, but can't let them in. That makes it worse. Right? There's a lot of danger for us in our movement to greater happiness and fulfillment in just these habits of mind. So that's inner danger. And be free of outer danger, it's not exactly like an incantation, it's more like a blessing. You know, it's not that different from saying, may things go well. You know, may you pass your bar exam. May the surgery go well. You know, may you be happy. May I be happy. And it's very much a feeling tone of blessing. It's gift giving. We're giving a gift of offering. And so we're extending that to ourselves as well as to others.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, when you were talking about equanimity, you mentioned that it's not a passive process, which makes me think of David White, and he talks about the frontier conversation, which is, you know, it's not that what we want to have happen is going to happen, and it's also what the universe wants of us. And in thinking about work, the topic of your book, and making decisions and choices in work that really serve us and bring us, like for me, like bring me alive and our service and things I'm passionate about and sharing my gifts. Can you talk about equanimity, like cultivating equanimity and how to make those decisions and choices and navigating a path to
Okay, so how to use equanimity in work, like real life work, in the sense of looking for a way of manifestation and commitment and power and passion, and where does equanimity fit in? Well, I often come back to this idea of generosity and where equanimity would fit in. Because that's where it fits in. It's being able to move toward a freely given gift. To have the joy or the satisfaction or your sense of integrity not based on how someone else is reacting, but on knowing your intention and knowing pretty well the skillfulness with which you've acted. So they say that the strongest predictor of happiness at work is a sense of meaning. That's what you're saying. And sometimes meaning is right there in the job description. And sometimes it's something we have to bring to the job. We have to infuse the job with a sense of meaning. And for many people that I have found in talking to many people, that really comes from how they are with the clients, the customers, the supervisors, the students, whatever it might be. And it's having a kind of commitment to presence, to compassion, much more than the task at hand. Although sometimes it is, you know, it's we have a sense of excellence. We want to do whatever we do just the best we can. But very often it's in connection that we find that sense of meaning. So, for example, this was after the book came out, I was doing a workshop, and I asked people, the title of the book is Real Happiness at Work, so I asked people, can you describe a time you were really happy at work? Like, what were the conditions? What was it like? So this one woman said, I work in a call-in center fielding customer complaints. And she said, I love everybody who calls. She said, by the time they get to me, they've already talked to 3 or 4 people, and they are madly frustrated. She said, I listen to everybody. I treat them with respect. I can't always help them, but I'm always honest. If I say I'm going to get back to someone by 3 o'clock, I get back to them by 3 o'clock. And I swear, this woman was radiant as she talked about her job. And having been a complaining customer, you know, like, we know it's not always like that. But not being so overwhelmed by coming what's at you. Having a certain sense of balance that feeds the compassion. Like, yeah, I would be furious too, you know, if I had that happen with that phone company. Maybe tomorrow I'll tell you my phone company story. You know, being able to see options, being balanced enough so that we have kind of a broader perspective on things. It's all those ways that equanimity comes in. Remembering there's praise and blame. If we're trying to decide the integrity of our actions solely on the basis of how someone else is reacting in the moment, we're kind of lost. Because it will always be shifting, it will always be changing. It doesn't mean we don't care, we do care, but we have another kind of groundedness that we can return to so that we can take everything in and take in the feedback and understand there's always going to be changing impressions. So the way the Buddha put it was, he said, there's always blame in this world. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world. And the story that's told about why he said that was, in that time, this man came to the monastery one day and he wanted to learn something of what the Buddha taught. So the first person he came upon was this monk who had taken a temporary vow of silence, and so he asked this monk, what does the Buddha teach? And the monk was silent. And the man became furious and he stomped away. So the same man came back a second day and came upon another disciple of the Buddha's, who was someone who was renowned not just for his great realization, but for his great theoretical understanding. So when he was asked to say something of what the Buddha taught, he went into a very long theoretical description, and the man got furious and he stomped away. So the same man came back a third day and came upon this other disciple of the Buddha's, this monk named Ananda. And they say, Ananda, having heard what happened on the first day and what happened on the second day, was careful to say something, but not too much. And the man got really angry. And he said something like, how dare you treat such profound matters so sketchily, and he stomped away. So this group of people went off to see the Buddha, and they said, oh, Lord Buddha, this is what happened on the first day, this is what happened on the second day, this is what happened on the third day, what do you have to say? And the Buddha said, there's always blame in this world. If you say nothing, some people will blame you. If you say a lot, some people will blame you. If you say just a little bit, some people will blame you. And we notice, and sometimes we learn from that, but we also have to keep in mind that's something we cannot control. So maybe I'll close with the story I usually tell in regard to that, which my first book was called Loving Kindness. It came out almost 20 years ago. It's kind of amazing. And it took me a very long time to write that book. Many of my colleagues already had books out, and I didn't think I could write a book. It's a whole long story, but I finally wrote it. And you can tell, if anyone has the original hardcover version, you can read the blurbs on the back, and it says things like, "We've waited a long time for this book." Someone else said, "In this long-awaited first book." Anyway, so it took me a really long time. And it felt like a huge accomplishment for me to have written the book. So soon after it came out, I was in California, and I was having lunch with somebody, and she said, "Oh, Sharon, you wrote that book in such a way, it's just like being with you. It's like sitting down and having a conversation with you." And I was completely thrilled. I thought, wow, it took me forever to get to this place. I finally did it. There's probably nothing more beautiful you can say to a writer than that. And I was so jazzed by the comment that that night I was having dinner with a whole other group of people, and I brought it up. And someone at the dinner table said, "Well, that's not true." She said, "I'm reading your book. It doesn't sound anything like you. It's nothing like being with you." And I thought, okay. You can be ecstatic at lunch and depressed at dinner. Or you could take a moment and remember it's the same book. Right? Written from whatever was motivating me at the time, with whatever level of skill I could bring forth. Someone felt one way about it, someone else felt another way about it, and I would never want to imply I didn't know the difference between lunch and dinner. I mean, of course we care. But the next question is, how much do we care? Are we completely defined by the views others are holding, without having any other grounding in which to sense? Did I do well? Did I do as well as I could? Where was I coming from? Because we will never be able to control. You cannot write the thing, or say the thing, or do the thing that will get only praise from everybody all of the time. It's just not in the cards. And so that's the way equanimity, which means wisdom, and the balance or the peace that's born of wisdom will come to play. Okay, I'm going to stop here. I want to thank you all. It's great to see you. I'll see some of you at least tomorrow and the next day, and may you be well and happy, and see you again.